name is Andreina.
And my name is Gabriela, and this is Wigs and Candles, a podcast about two sisters and their obsession with period film.
We want to dig into our favorite films and review them. Find out why we love them, how they shaped us, what effect do they have on us.
Join us on a trip through palaces and manors, balls and tea parties, and a lot of dresses, carriages, and of course, wigs and candles.
In this episode, Bridgerton, and a special guest. Welcome to Wigs and Candles. We wanted to close this series of podcasts with a special episode and discuss not a film, but an entire television series. We also thought it would be fun to bring a special guest.
Yes, our sister Adriana, a successful mechanical engineer who lives and works in the Silicon Valley in sunny California. Also, she is a huge TV fan. She knows a thing or two about what makes a good TV show. Although Adriana is not a period film fan in particular, she is a passionate fan of the art of storytelling through television. Welcome, Adri.
Hello, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Hello, Adriana. We are so excited that you're here. It was a hard to coordinate all of our schedules. We're in two continents and three different countries. So thank you so much for taking the time to be here today. We couldn't be more excited. So we invited you to this episode because Bridgerton is the only TV series we are discussing so far in the podcast. And we consider you to be an expert in this area. But before we start going through the discussion, Gabby, can you give us a bit of a summary of what the series is about?
Sure, Nene. Bridgerton is a television period drama series created by Chris Van Dusen and produced by Shonda Rhimes. It is based on the novels by Julia Quinn. The story itself takes place in London in 1813 and portrays the aristocratic Bridgerton family, consisting of a widowed mother and her 8 children.
Oh, Lord.
The drama itself focuses on the eldest daughter, Daphne, who is about to debut her first season, you know, when the young ladies were presented to society. And this is, of course, all full of intrigue and drama, thanks to their neighbors, the Featheringtons, but also thanks to the mysterious Lady Whistledown, who knows everything about everyone in town, but no one knows her identity, the Duke of Hastings, and many other characters. What makes the series interesting is that the story is set on an alternate history where people of color are fully integrated in the aristocracy, including the queen herself, Queen Charlotte. So this, while doing the research for our podcast, I found out that apparently this special touch placing the story on this alternate history was given by the creator, Chris Van Dusen, who says, and I quote, "The series is not colorblind because that would imply that color and race were never considered when color and race are part of the show." So that was Bridgerton in a nutshell.
All right. No, thank you, Gabby. Thank you for that detailed summary of what the series is about. So it is indeed more complicated to talk about a TV show that has 9, 10, 11 episodes than just talking about a movie. So thank you so much for doing that. So, Adriana, Bridgerton is a Shonda Rhimes production. It's also her first scripted Netflix series. we know that you have been watching TV from the early, very early days when TV shows started to really become, you know, very good and critically acclaimed and so on. So do you know Shonda Rhimes? What can you tell us about her and what kind of influence do you think she had in how Bridgerton was made?
Well, I mean, so I watched two Shonda shows, which are pretty famous. So Shonda, she has two famous shows. One is Grey's Anatomy, the other one is Scandal. She has other shows, How to Get Away with Murder, and she has another one that I don't remember right now, but she's a famous shows. But and the first one where she found, you know, a lot of success was Grey's Anatomy. And that show, it's been going on for a long time. I think it's on the, 18th season, whatever, or 15th. It's going on for a long time. And, and you know, that was the first show I watched. And you tell the truth, I mean, when I started watching that show, Grey's Anatomy, the first seasons were really good. So, and it was really interesting, the way she will empower women on the show and minorities. So you're watching the show and you're not really noticing that, but as you're watching the show, then you start realizing, oh, all these characters are so interesting and so different from regular shows. And then you start noticing, oh, this is because, you know, it is a different show. And then, you know, I don't know if you know about Grey's Anatomy, but it's basically a show about doctors. And then Grey, the Grey's in the name of Grey's Anatomy is Meredith Grey, which is the protagonist. That's her name, Meredith Grey. So it's a word, you know, a wordplay on Grey's Anatomy, which is, you know, a book, an anatomy book. Yeah.
All right, all right.
A book, a textbook for medicine, right? So, and then she's a surgeon first. She's a woman. She's a surgeon. Is the show, they are all surgeons. So it's already kind of different, right? That a woman is a surgeon. Yeah. And then there are other women surgeons because in the team, right? Because they're residents. They're just starting to get into the hospital. They're starting their residency in this hospital. So once you start watching the show, you'll see, like, you know, the head of the surgery department is a woman and it's a Black woman. And then, you know, all these characters, you know, like Meredith's best friend is the wonderful Sandra Oh, you know, she's Asian. And they are not defined by their, it's not like they are ignoring their characteristics, but they're not defined by them either, you know, like everybody, you know, all the characters are very well defined, very interesting. So if you start watching Grey's Anatomy, you may get into it right away. And then what I will say about Shonda's shows is that everything is a little bit exaggerated, you know, like the romance is exaggerated, like everything, all the emotions are exaggerated, are too much, you know. If you follow Grey's Anatomy and you go through Meredith meeting, I know, Dr. Dreamy, I don't know if I'm talking crazy things here, I don't know if I'm like just saying, but you know, there's romance in the show, the emotions of the characters are really over the top.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And then the other thing about Shonda's shows that are kind of ridiculous is that the characters are so self-important that they all go on and on about, you know, they talk a lot about their feelings and, you know, sometimes it can become too much.
Wow.
But, you know, if you look at Shonda and what she has become, she has become a very powerful producer in Hollywood. And the reason is, I was reading about her a little bit, and then she kind of goes for what she wants. So she wanted to build a show. She wanted to do, you know, Grey's Anatomy, and she was very successful with a very diverse cast, very diverse. If you look at Grey's Anatomy, you know, you can search it up. Grey's Anatomy have an incredible cast of actors that started with the show. And then if you go to Scandal, it's even more, you know, because you have your first protagonist, she's a Black woman. And then it's a show that's very diverse. is very empowers this woman, Olivia Pope. I mean, the Olivia Pope character is an incredible character. She's an incredibly, you know, educated woman, very savvy, very smart, that, you know, very ambitious, incredibly ambitious, and very unapologetic about her ambition. So in a way, you know, Olivia Pope is a little bit like Shonda Rhimes.
Yes.
Because she is very unapologetically ambitious, goes for it. And then she did this Bridgerton, and the way the whole thing with Netflix worked is that, you know, ABC is her original channel where, you know, she was doing all these shows with ABC, Grey's Anatomy, all the shows are with ABC. That's where she grew. That's where she made like kind of her empire. And then suddenly, you know, ABC was not treating her that well, was not paying her what she thought she deserved. And, you know, Netflix wanted her. And then as all women, right, once we are comfortable with a job, right, we're like, let's not rock the boat. You know, I'm comfortable here. I'm getting what I deserve until you realize I'm not getting what I deserve. And that's what happened to her. Mm. And then she said, you know what? I'm going to take that Netflix opportunity. And she talked to her lawyer. She's or to her whatever. And she said, you know what? Get me to talk to Netflix. And so of course, Netflix offered her, you know, a lot of money to go with them. And then what happens is that she produces this show. I think they hire her to produce a different show. But in the meantime, she did Bridgerton. And then, of course, it was incredibly successful. So you have a person that the way she approaches things is not a middle ground, right? She is over the top. And then once you watch her shows, you will be like, this is too over the top. And so I approach Bridgerton knowing... because I wow. have already watched Grey's Anatomy. Once the whole family of Meredith died, I'm like, I'm done. They all died. Like, there was a plane crash. I mean, I hope I'm not spoiling this for
no, anyone. No.
Grey's Anatomy has been going on forever.
I will never watch a Grey's Anatomy.
Grey's Anatomy has been going. I actually recommend the first like 5 seasons are amazing. Pretty much, you will cry, you will laugh. I mean, you will find wonderful characters. But I mean, this poor lady, right? Her husband, her sister, her mom, her dad, absolutely everyone around her had died in tragic ways. I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I cannot take it anymore. And then Scandal was the same. I didn't even finish it. But
so do you recognize Shonda's style in the production of Bridgerton?
So when I started watching Bridgerton, and then the reason why I was very hesitant to give Bridgerton a chance, and then the story about why did I start watching is because my sister Andreina was like, can you watch this show? Because we want to talk about it. And I'm like, okay. I mean, like, everybody's talking about it. So I will watch it with an objective eye. And that's what I tried to do. And then I was a little hesitant because I knew Shonda's style of over the top emotion and characters that were, you know, a little bit too self-conscious and too self-important. Mm-hmm. And they were going to these rants that, you know, that were actually very annoying. Yeah. So that's how I kind of approached Bridgerton, being like kind of weary, you know, kind of like, let's see what it is. And I was surprised actually that it was not as bad as I thought.
This is going to be a nice discussion because it looks like she surprised you somehow.
Yeah,
with her style. Yeah,
and then but if you look at Bridgerton, she did not write it. She's a producer, so of course there is influence her influence can be, you know, can be seen in the show. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's very diverse cast. And, you know, and actually I was reading about this Chris Van Dusen when he said that the show is not colorblind, which I don't think I agree with, because it is kind of colorblind, like race is not addressed at all. So, yeah. but I guess we can talk about it. Like,
we
I don't
can,
know
yeah,
what
yeah,
he
yeah,
meant.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I really don't know what he meant by that, but, you know,
we're going to talk about that a little bit later. We're going to definitely touch on that. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was, I will say Shonda's influence was kind of control a little bit, kind of tamper down on this show, maybe on purpose. So it wouldn't be too overly Shonda-rise. And because she's a producer, right? She was able to influence it in the way she knows how to create a successful show.
Can we talk about Bridgerton? Because that and thank you so much for that incredible introduction about Shonda Rhimes. And that's why we brought you to this
yes.
episode, because you are an expert. We know that. We know you know.
I don't want to say I'm an expert, but yes.
Yes. Yes. Yeah,
I just watch a lot of TV.
Well, but that's
makes you
thing.
An expert.
I have to say, when the kind of like the golden era of TV started, I always been a snob and a purist. And I was like, no, I'm not going to watch TV. I'm all about the movies, the Oscars, and so on and so on. And there you were watching Buffy, watching Lost, watching all the important shows when they started to come out. And you were telling me, you know what? I'm so disappointed of movies. I am much more invested in these characters and the time it takes to develop them and so on in the format. You were one of the first people to kind of embrace the format wholeheartedly with no hesitation, where I was like, no, it's not for me, etc., etc. Obviously, all of that is gone. We are 20 years into this renaissance, and now we have, you know, essentially TV can be art as much as a movie. So thank you so much for that introduction. And I wanna bring it back to Shonda. I mean, what you said is so interesting that I was going to point that out, that I was looking at the episodes of Bridgerton. There's 8 episodes in the season, and she didn't write any of them. She produced it, and she put her name behind it, which is huge. So I think that definitely must have impacted the whole storyline, the development of the characters. But you know, there's a different, I mean, it's so interesting everything you say, because it really, I can see now her fingers, it, her yes. fingers throughout.
It explains a lot.
You can see her fingers. And then yeah. I think, you can kind of correct me if I'm wrong, but I think a few of the writers from her shows are writing Bridgerton too. So, yeah. You can see her influence. It's especially on the female characters. And I think the most Shonda Rhimes character is the sister of Daphne. I think Daphne is her name.
Yeah, we're going to talk about maybe some of the
so
characters.
I think,
as I think
you can see in some of the characters, like this is a very Shonda character, you know, like you can identify this character that is so, you know, like
self-assured,
Christina Yang of the Christina Yang, right, is what Sandra Oh's character in Grey's Anatomy, and she's like, you know, she's this character that is completely out of any, you know, standard of what you ever seen a character, a female character, you know.
I
so
see.
there's always this character in her shows that is like stands out. So I will say that was the sister is not as complex and as wonderful as it was, you know, Christina Yang's character in Grey's Anatomy. But you can tell that this is her style. You know, like you can see it in the show.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe we can talk a little bit more in general about the. One of the things that makes Bridgerton kind of so successful. So the novels are set in the Regency era in London. But what we see is that the producers created this parallel history, you know, where, for example, the Queen herself, Queen Charlotte, has a mixed race heritage. And the main character, the main male character, the Duke of Hastings, he is black himself. So this It makes it stand out from many other shows, or especially many period productions, period films or period series at all. So on the other hand, they also leave certain facts intact. So they play with this combination of mixing their fantasy imagination of how Regency London could have looked like with real facts. Yeah, like, for example, King George is mentioned sometimes during the 8 episodes, and they all know, and you as a viewer also know through their views, that King George was mentally ill. So they keep that fact for real. Mm. So what do you both think about this? I know that Nene was a little bit, when we first saw Bridgerton at the beginning of the year, and we talked about this, you mentioned, Nene, that you were kind of a little bit annoyed. You said, they made it all look like this is not accurate to the time, and this is not accurate to history. So what do you think about this mixture of parallel history?
Well, yeah, first of all, yeah, we watched this show when it came out early in the year, right? So it was like a kind of like a Christmas holidays kind of, or early like winter show. And I wasn't as much bothered by the fact that they had included, black characters or people of color in the plot, in the story, mixed with the white people. It was not as much that bothered me, but I feel they were a little bit either lazy or they didn't think through the implications of the implications of the casting, the implications of making the Duke of Hastings black, the implications of being obvious that Queen Charlotte had mixed race, having Marina, the Marina character, and having black people moving about in English aristocracy at the beginning of the 19th century. So I think now what Adriana explained to us, that this is kind of like an important trademark of Shonda Rhimes shows, which is the diverse cast. They said, well, of course, this is a Shonda Rhimes produced show. We need to have, we have to do the same. And this is, Hamilton did it. And that is a complex conversation. It is a complex conversation. It's a nuanced conversation that, what happens when you portray historical characters that were white, when you have black people interpreting doing the performance of those characters, inhabiting those characters. So Bridgerton kind of did the same. And for me, what bothered me was not so much that it was inaccurate, because bring it on. Bring on the fantasy. What if?
What if? Yeah.
What if? What if? But take it all the way through. And I think they were a bit lazy, because a lot of the things that they could have done, they didn't do. In fact, I think a lot of the things that, for example, the Duke of Hastings, himself does, kind of underwhelms the whole idea of him being black and beautiful and aristocratic, some of his behavior and so on. So that was what bothered me. There are other little things that we can touch a little bit better. For example, the sister Eloise, I was completely annoyed, because she's like a proto-feminist that smokes and so on.
And she's the one, this is the one that I'm saying, is the most Shonda-like character that you can find. Oh. You can find this character in every Shonda show.
But instead of having
all the complexities of the original character, sassy character, which is Christina Yang in Grey's Anatomy, which is a wonderful character. It was one of the most wonderful characters ever in television, portrayed by wonderful Sandra Oh. This is simplified in the annoying Eloise.
and she
has zero of the complexities of Christina. Yeah.
Yes.
Then this is where you get like, okay, this is a recipe that has worked. Let's try apply it here, but it's just a simplified recipe that doesn't have all the wonderful complexities that the original recipe had.
So this is certainly also something that is completely not accurate to those times, because maybe such women, they wouldn't stood out so much, and they wouldn't have so much freedom as Eloise apparently had in her family. So.
Well, I think, if we want to talk about Eloise, and actually I thought the Eloise actor was pretty good and actually kind of elevated a little bit of the character more than it deserved, because she was a good actor. But the character was written so simple and so annoyingly that, you know, it didn't work. But, you know, even if this is a fantasy, right? Like you say, you take it all the way.
Yeah.
Because it's not realistic to have all these characters interacting this way, but make it so it's, you know, it is relatable. And that those, yeah. So you can relate to this character in a way instead of making it, this character is annoying. So this is like a, you know, it's like a tricky thing, right? Like, yeah, you want to have this character that speaks for all women and for all of that, but it just, the tone didn't work, you know, even though the actor, I thought she was good, and then she was trying to make it work.
Yeah,
but it didn't quite work. And then the casting, in my opinion, this idea of like a colorblind casting, which is not supposed to be colorblind, but just a diverse casting in a period film. So like I embrace it and I like it. I have no problems with it. I actually love this idea of like just hire the best people, you know, to be here, and which I don't think they did, you know, because you cannot just go and hire, let's just hire this black guy and, you know,
you think this was just like, a clever move from the makers of this series to make it today kind of socially compliant with all the topics that we have
on the table
to be diversity?
I think, yeah.
That the production has now really set up like the trend to how make casts look like for the future. So you think that they're making it on purpose to be kind of like socially compliant to today's topics and diversity and whatever, or do they really mean it seriously?
I don't know if they mean it seriously. I'm not sure. But I think it didn't work all the way, in my opinion. And the reason why is like I found the queen character to be wonderful. So that actress was wonderful. The Duke of Hastings, what was her name? Auntie or Lady?
Lady Danbury.
Lady Danbury, like that actor was wonderful. So those characters kind of worked. So that was perfect. Like that was perfect casting. And those actors brought, you know, like, so I totally kind of, and I want to embrace, like, I want more shows to embrace this diversity. But I don't think Bridgerton actually is, they are telling you, we are embracing this, but they're not really. Because why are all of Daphne's brothers, actors, so bland? Like, who are these people? Like, I couldn't even tell them apart. I didn't even know their names. So bringing interesting actors and bring diversity, because diversity, you cannot just say, oh, I'm just gonna hire one black person, and this is not diversity, right? I mean actual diversity. You have to bring it. You have to work on it. You cannot just say, oh, I hired these for white people because they were the best. No, that's not, you're not working hard enough. So you can find four people, you know, this is not diverse. This is not the way it works. But this is basically what they did, right? Okay. So the Duke of Hastings is black, and then the queen. And so these characters, so some of them work, like I said, but some of them didn't work. And it felt like they were just hired to be diverse.
To fill the goal. So if I get your impressions, both of you, correctly, you're saying that this was kind of superficial. And what Nene meant before, that you say, okay, they didn't really went into the discussion of, okay, what if these people were really in the high-ranking positions of aristocracy? And my impression back then when I saw the series was that I actually found it kind of interesting to throw this with no comments to the audience to see, just think about it. We are not as a producing series. Yeah. We, the makers, are not going to throw a word on it. You have to make your thoughts for yourself, viewer. What if people look like this in high aristocracy back then? So I think that that they left it uncommented and that they didn't really go into the discussion was for me actually kind of like, we have taken this for granted in our parallel world. So this is normal for us. So this is why I found that they didn't really go into this, you know, why the queen was black and why the duke was black and so on. That they didn't go into detail about it, I actually find it kind of cool. Because I said, okay, they've taken it for granted. This was supposed to be normal.
I agree with you, because this is why that comment is weird to me, because you are bringing a diverse cast to this period show, and then it's obviously not realistic, right? So you cannot address it. How are you going to?
You cannot address it.
But
exactly.
So I don't think that was the problem, actually.
So Nene,
can I say something? The thing is that, and I'm sorry, I could. The thing is that I feel usually very kind of unprepared to talk about race and all of these things. I think there's a lot of people on TV and writing about TV and writing about movies who are so well equipped to talk about this. And I've been reading a lot. I've been reading a lot. Some of the critics I like, some of the people who write about TV, especially there's this TV and movie, black TV and movie critic here in Canada. Her name is Kathleen Newman-Rimack. And she did a very interesting conversation on Refinery 29, where they discussed the issue of race in Bridgerton. And the issue is that they did try to address it. They did try to say, for example, I think it's in episode 4 or 5, it's like midway, when the auntie, which is a fantastic character, in fact, Lady Danbury is the only character I actually like in this whole series. And it's a great part because of the actress who's portraying her. I believe her name is Ajoa Ando. What she says, you are throwing your opportunities away. We were given this opportunity by the monarchy to elevate our race. You know, it's our job to kind of continue to be perfect, continue to be the best. And sort of they throw in there, they try to kind of give an explanation and then they drop it.
Okay. I think I missed that.
She said,
I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
And they after that, nothing happens. And I think that little nugget of information when she said we were given this opportunity to elevate our race. She doesn't say race. They say us.
Yeah.
They use the word us a lot. But let me just finish, because this complicates the Duke of Hastings character, which I find extremely flat.
Totally flat.
And no depth. But it would have been such an opportunity to give him a conflict, more depth than the actual conflict he's given. His father is the villain of the series. He's the villain of the story. He's a horrendous man. And essentially, the Duke of Hastings, he wants to take revenge on his father and end the line and the dukedom, I guess. Just to say, I'm not going to have any children because this is my revenge on you, where it would have been so much more complicated that he says, this is the opportunity I have, you know, to elevate our race. Like, you introduce this theme and it's a missed opportunity.
The series will continue. So maybe they go into that for the second, third, or fourth season. Who knows?
Well, I don't know, because I don't know much about Bridgerton, but I think the Duke of Hastings and Daphne's story is done, and then they're going with the other Bridgerton kids, which are like the most boring characters ever to exist. So I don't even know why would we even bother caring about them, like do a show about them. Like, I couldn't even tell who they were at the end, like how many they were or anything. But what? I mean, go for it, I guess.
I have a question. What do you think? Because, okay, so obviously during their conversation so far, you know, I think we agreed that the concept was very interesting. First of all, having a period piece, having people, black people, people of color, in period clothing. We discussed this topic when we talked about Belle in our previous episode, and we concluded that that's one of, is we want to see more of that. So yes. This is wonderful. And Gabby, what you said, I really love that, that they kind of drop it there and let the audience decide what to make of it. But I think, why do you think it kind of failed? I mean, and not only in terms of the representation of race, you know, the a lot of people have talked about colorism, how you have the main Black characters being lighter skinned. That is even another conversation altogether. But why are the entire cast so boring? Why are these characters so bland? I mean, is it a failure of writing? Is it a failure of the novels? Because true, I cannot distinguish the brothers and sisters. Well, the sisters a bit more, but the Bridgerton brothers, I also cannot tell them apart. And there's so many other things that are annoying too.
Yes, I think we can of course only speculate. Yeah, but maybe it's because they tried to check too many boxes at the same time. They wanted to make a modern show with diverse cast, with a flippy kind of modern production. You know, the dresses are not quite accurate to the time, so they throw that flash of color also in there. And they want a lot of, you know, this passionate relationship between Daphne and the Duke. And they wanted maybe to cover up too much and too many characters. And they didn't really focus on taking each character in depth. So, for example, we see now, as Adriana mentioned before, during this first season, the focus of the entire story is this story, the love story between Daphne and the Duke. Yeah. And the characters themselves are kind of flat. I mean, the Duke is very flat. Daphne shows a little bit more of, you know, she's kind of smart and self-determined and so on. But that's pretty much it. And they left all those characters. There's so many people around them. Not really taking the chance of developing the characters themselves. And, well, also the story between Daphne and the Duke is based on one thing. You know, their love.
I think definitely the show had a lot of potential. And I, you know, when I was watching the first episode, I was pretty bored. Like, it didn't grab me, right? Until the end, when Daphne and Duke Hastings decide to fake their relationship, say, you know, I can take advantage of this, you know, like we can have an arrangement and then, you know, this is what I get and this is what you get and let's do it. And at that moment I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like two characters, you know, that are in the same wavelength, like they're pretty smart, both of them, and they can get to an arrangement. And then, so that kind of was like, oh, that's really interesting, right? Let's see how it goes. And then, you know, so there was a lot of potential that didn't go anywhere. Like, it was very interesting to me at the beginning, how Daphne and the Duke of Hastings, they were very different, but they had like a common, you know, goal that they wanted to find, you know, that this arrangement will work for them. And at the same time, they were finding like each other really interesting. And I wish it would have kept going that way instead of what happened, which was suddenly they got married and it was like such a big mess. It like completely went in a way that I didn't expect when I was having fun with the whole
intrigue.
Getting to know each other, and then this is very intriguing, and then, you know, what was the name? Lady Whistledown, was that mystery was going on, and then what is happening with that? So that made it like the first half of the season, like really interested, and suddenly they're married, and then the whole issue
kind of
changes. Very
completely
suddenly.
And this is what I meant, that you just see two pretty actors having a relationship, but you don't know really why they are attracted to each other apart from the sex. They have a pure sexual relationship.
Can I add something here? I think if we stay a little bit in the topic of, you know, why, because I think we have concluded that the series didn't quite work out for us, at least for me, didn't quite work out. In terms of the story, something that kind of bothered me, that was very intriguing, the fact that they found this common ground, let's do this, and that was cool. But I, something that really kind of bothered me a little bit is, and I'm not an expert, how like Adriana, that she understands character development, and I think what failed a little bit was the development of the other characters. Their stories were boring. Their stories were flat as well. But also, everybody, the only thing they care about is Daphne, the most boring of girls. Even the queen, the only thing she cared about was reading Lady Whistledown letter or pamphlet. For me, that's like the world, the rich world building that you have in a period film when you have all these, you know, historical things happening, or and it's, this is not a historical film, but you need richness. You need something to fill in the spaces, to make the stakes higher. And for me, you know, just everything is hanging on this girl. And you know, Jane Austen wrote about this, the, you know, girls that needed to marry, but she did it in such a way that it was so much richer, so much deeper. Of course, we're not asking this show to be Jane Austen, but I think they could have given us more interesting
characters. Yeah, I think some characters have a lot of potential to be way more interesting. And the Marina character, this is the girl that came, right? Like the cousin that came and then find out she's pregnant. And I thought she was a very interesting character because she was seen as a kind of like a, no, you know, like kind of self-serving character. Like she just wanted to get out of her situation, but it was driven by desperation, basically. So I thought she was like the most, in a way, the most relatable character, one of the most complex ones, because she was not a bad person, but she did some bad things. Right? Like she was like, I'm going to find a husband and I'm going to do whatever it takes. But not because she was a bad person, but because she was like, you know, I'm set on fixing this. I'm set on getting out of this. And then she was not, you know, but she was also very vulnerable. She was also, you know, left behind. She fell in love and her lover kind of left it. So she, her character, like, I was so much more interested in Marina's story than in Daphne, because Daphne, even though, again, I will say Daphne's actor, she was very good.
Yeah.
She kind of elevated the character.
Yes, totally. She tried and she managed as much as she could.
She gave Daphne some depth that I was actually impressed. With her, even though I was not impressed with the casting, she just looked too young next to the Duke of Hastings. I'm sorry, I just had to say that. And that was a problem for me. She looked like she was 12, he looked like he was 35. And when they got married and everything changed, that was pretty weird.
Everything changed.
So, but she was a good actress, and she was trying to give. But the Daphne character, even though Daphne character was a little bit deeper than I thought she was, like I thought she was just this bland girl, but in fact she was pretty smart, and you know, and she was kind of way more interesting than I thought she would be. Again, they lost that potential. She had so much potential. And they simplified her whole storyline into this one issue.
Yes.
And even though Daphne's relationship with the Duke of Hastings had so much potential too.
Yeah.
Of finding these two people that were so different, finding and learning from each other, they didn't. because they threw them. I don't know. I haven't read the novels. It may be that this is a novel problem instead of a show problem. Mm. I don't know. But they throw them into this marriage, and it was very anticlimactic, I say, the whole building up to this relationship and just having them just kind of their relationship be reduced to this one issue. So we can talk about it. I don't know if we want to go into Daphne's and Deduka Hastings' relationship, which we can, I guess.
Which is very flat because it's all about one thing.
Sex.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's about potential and missed opportunities and missed potential. True, I believe the actress was really good. And, you know, Daphne, she has to get married. This is, you know, she's not in such a desperate situation as other period film heroines where, you know, they're
like Marina or as Marina, right?
Yeah, exactly.
She has to get married.
Exactly. She's not, so her situation is not desperate. She just needs a good husband. She doesn't need money. She's fine. She has a good name, all of that. So she really, what needs is happiness, essentially. That's her. And essentially ensure that her sisters can marry well as well. So this is what is at stake for Daphne. And I do think that the actress was able to imbue the character with intelligence and, you know, that touch of sensuality, which takes us to the next topic, which is sex. Let's talk about it. There's a lot of sex in the show. And this was one of the selling points of the show. Oh, the show is racy. It's a period film. It's fantasy. It's dresses, balls, and sex. So what do you think? What do you think about the sex in the series and about the, you know, the relationship between Daphne and the Duke? Adriana, let's start with you.
Okay. So is the show, this is a funny show because it is a lot of sex, but it's not a sexy show. I mean, I don't know how to explain it. And this goes back to the lack or how American cinema and American TV shows, mostly American cinema, has gotten rid of sex and sexiness and sensual things, you know, in scenes in movies. And if you go, and, you know, I just want to just very little go back to the 80s, you know, 70s and 80s, you know, American films where they always have this sex scene, you know, there was sex in films. There were people being attracted to each other. And if you watch old movies, and actually I was watching a movie that's completely unrelated to this conversation, which is Terminator. Terminator is a famous movie. We watched this movie, it was on TV, the sex scene was never shown, but I think recently I just watched this movie and then I watched it in the actual, the actual complete movie has a really long sex scene. Like, I was surprised because we don't see that in modern films. Like, sex in this, American films have decided sex is not a thing, you know, that they want to show. And so we go to Bridgerton and then the selling point is like, oh, there's a lot of sex. And then people want to see it, right? So it was this thing, but then the sex itself is so unsexy. And I don't know if that was the point. I don't think it was. And I don't know. I mean, you have these two attractive characters, but again, I think the casting was a little bit, it kind of didn't work, in my opinion, between... Daphne did all she could. She looked too young for the Duke of Hastings. That was one thing. But at least she was trying. I could feel Daphne's attraction to the Duke. I could see it. But the Duke, the actor, even though he's very attractive, he's an attractive guy, I could not feel anything for him. Like, I could not feel like he was attracted to Daphne at all. And that, again, it came back to these scenes where all this sex is happening very suddenly, by the way. There was no warning in this. which is fine. And I was like, this could be better. I mean, this, this sex is not sexy. I mean, I'm kind of laughing at this. So, and I don't think it was Daphne's fault, like Daphne's character or Daphne's actor's fault. I think she put herself through that, and I think she worked hard to get that. And I'm not blaming this guy, the Duke of Hastings. It maybe there was no chemistry between them. I'm not too sure, because at the beginning of the show, I thought there was chemistry. Only when the sex started happening, it was like, no. And then so I started thinking, maybe American shows and American TV shows and American movies have forgotten how to even film an actually sexy scene. And if you watch a movie called Lost Caution, by Ang Lee. I don't know if you watch this movie. It's a movie. It's about, you know, this girl that got into trouble because, you know, in the Chinese Revolution, and then she decided she wanted to be a spy, and then she started, she becomes the lover of one powerful guy to spy on him, and she falls in love. That's kind of like the sexiest movie that I've ever seen. Like all the sex scenes, like you watch that. If you watch that movie and you watch the sex scenes, you are like, you are watching something. You will never find anything like that in American shows or movies. And then it's like American society have decided, you know, sex is bad. And then I'm going to show sex, but I'm not going to make it sexy, because then that will be bad. And
that would be
but it's interesting that this happens in a Shonda show. And because if you watch Shonda shows, they have a lot of sex in it. And of course, this is a Netflix show, so they show more sex, like more explicit sex. But obviously, Shonda's shows don't show sex as explicit, because it's public television, so it's not as explicit, but there is a lot of sex. And especially Scandal, Grey's Anatomy too, but especially Scandal has a lot of sex, I have to say. I mean, so I recommend that. It's good. And then, but the characters, what I'm saying, again, if you watch that show, if you watch Scandal, and you watch the first scene with Olivia Pope's character meets President Grant, which was never, he was no president yet, but when they meet, they are not having sex.
And they're
talking, and then you can feel the attraction. Like, they sell you, the actors really, really, really have a lot of chemistry. They sell you this.
Yes, and I think
this is what is missing from this.
This is what is missing, and this is what we talked about before, that since both characters, I mean, Daphne did as much as she could, or the actress did as much as you could to give Daphne something, that the relationship is very flat, it's very superficial, and it's all also due in many ways to the motivation of the Duke not to marry. So that is already his motivation of not wanting to marry Daphne and not wanting to have sex with Daphne. It was also obvious. It was also kind of silly in a way, you know, to say,
yes,
I kind of marry because I don't want to have kids, you know? And they make it all look like exactly what you're saying, this taboo topic. They wanted to make like the topic of the entire relationship. So this is the thing that doesn't really spark the real passion and the real intimacy in the relationship, because the relationship itself is just very flat. It's very superficial. In my way, in my eyes. I found these things okay. I had my fun watching. I had my fun watching, but I completely get that they were not leveled. Both characters, they were not, you don't have the feeling that they really love each other. They're just hungry for passion. That's pretty much
it. You know, and they don't have to love each other, right? Like, you can have, you know, characters having sex. And even if you go to the brother, one of the brothers, who knows what his name was. And he was one of the brothers, I think. I don't know how many they were. And one of them, whoever.
Oh, God. The eldest brother.
The eldest brother. Yeah, whatever. And then he had an affair with the opera singer. And then, obviously, they also wanted to make these scenes sexy. And they were not. They try hard. And then I was watching, and I don't even feel like the actors are to blame, because I think the actors kind of threw themselves at it. But it was something about the way it was filmed, and it was too over the top. Like, they made it.
It was too pushed. Over. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But when they try too hard, it loses the authenticity. So.
I agree with everything both of you have said on the topic. Like, I agree a lot. But I think we see two relationships where we see sex happening. I think it's the brother with the opera singer and Daphne and the Duke. I think those are the only two. And neither are sexy. None of those scenes are sexy. Yeah, you enjoy it. I'm like, okay, great. It's nice. It's pretty. But I think if we say that it's not the fault of the actors, I think it's the fault of the writing. I think the writing is what's failing here. Why? Because the first sex scene that happens in the entire series, I think it happens even in the first episode, is the opera singer and the brother, the older brother Bridgerton. And it's like this super super, like, oh, passionate sex scene, and they bump into walls and stuff. Like, and you're introduced into this world like this. So, first of all, there's no backstory to both of them, which is okay, but also there was no sense to any of it.
No,
so if we move on to the relationship between Daphne and the Duke, like Adriana said, the first half of the season when they're faking their relationship is quite sexy. I mean, they when they stay in the innuendo, when they stay in that, it was pretty effective. There's a famous spoon licking scene that is quite effective. I found that because Because we are inside Daphne's interior world. We see the Duke through her eyes, and he's licking the spoon, and she's shivering a little bit. This is wonderful. There's another scene where they're looking at a painting, and their fingers almost touch. You feel the tension. That's well done. When it becomes explicit, when it becomes, okay, let's have sex and let's kiss and so on, truly, there's a lack of chemistry between the actors, but I think the main fault is the writing, because it didn't build up to this. It didn't build up to the comfort, the physical comfort. And I want to say something before we continue. I told this to Gabby when we were watching way back in January. I think I've been spoiled by Outlander, and neither Gabby or Adriana has watched a little bit of Outlander, but not all.
And I thought you were going to mention Outlander, yes.
Yes, and I'm going to mention Outlander because for me, despite everything you can say about Outlander, the relationship and the sexual relationship between the two main characters, who are adults, is one of the most beautiful I have ever seen. In fact, it's a fictional relationship that has given me hope in heterosexual relationships. In fact, like the possibility of the beauty of a heterosexual relationship, it has kind of given me faith again, restored my faith in the relationship between men and women. It is so beautifully portrayed, and it's so beautifully written. There's an intimacy, there's a knowledge of each other, there's a knowledge of the minds, there's a compassion, there's a lot of things that go behind the sex scene when it happens. Like, there's this entire preparation, there's this entire depth of the relationship, and all of that is brought to the sex scene. It is not, happening in a void.
That what you're saying is so important, because when you look at period films and sex and all of that, you know, if you look at all period films, like Dangerous Liaisons, which was a very sexy film, and then I think the last, you know, like kind of like the last sex scene that I found really sensual in mainstream films was Atonement, which was a film that was not my favorite film because many reasons, but that scene between the main characters.
Keira Knightley
and
James McAvoy.
And James McAvoy. And all, you know, what brings you to that scene is all the background, what you're saying, right? The whole setup. They set it up.
Because you don't see much. You don't see much,
but they set the way they set it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's taking like a bath and she's thinking, and then he's remembering, you know, their conversations, and all of that brings you to that point.
Yes.
And up to that point, the movie was wonderful, and then it went downhill. But up to that point, you know, if you think about scenes like that, and James McAvoy is a wonderful actor, and I think someone asking like, how can you have chemistry with everyone? Yeah. And he's like, I'm an actor.
Wow, I can act.
Yeah, and then of course, and he, you know, there is another scene with him because I mean, I can talk about James McAvoy forever.
Me too.
There is another scene in another movie, actually with Kerry Washington from Scandal, which is The Last King of Scotland. He has a sex scene with her too in that movie. And again, the whole setup to the sex scene happens. And when it happens, you know, you feel it, right? So if you think about that, how they set it up, and then you talk about Orlando and also how they set up the sex scene. It's not about all. It's not only how the sex scene is filmed, which I think it has a lot to do, but also the whole setup. You know, like how do you get to this point? And then in Bridgerton, that was done so poorly. Like I thought it was very sexy. It was way sexier before they were having sex.
Yes, totally. They went straight to it. They went straight. And to then it, and once they got it up.
Yeah, and then once they got married. And they got to it, then it lost all sex.
It lost the charm.
Yeah, the setup was not there. It wasn't justified.
They missed it.
Yeah. Same thing. Yeah, same thing with the brother.
No, exactly. And I'm going to say here, because I remember when I first talked about this with Gabby, it's like, come on, the Duke of Hastings, so much promise, how he was licking the spoon. God damn it, that was sexy, that was beautiful. And then when he came to it, like, can you kiss a little bit? Can you talk a little?
The spoon licking scene had so much potential. We were spoiled by that scene.
Yeah.
And then they let us down.
And they let us down.
By the unsexy sex they were
having. Yeah, because I think the Duke of Hastings, and I think dumb, it's the fault.
And his dumb, you know. Problem, he couldn't go
all the way, but I think it's the writing because it's funny. It is very interesting to me, and I guess we need to move on from this topic, but yes. It's very interesting. But it is interesting to me that a show that is geared towards a female audience, because here we are talking about period films, and we haven't talked about costumes and all of that because our conversation has taken long enough. This is a show about romance, and on top of it, in period, because it's for a female audience, obviously. And it's so interesting to me that they wrote the male character so poorly in terms of his, you know, his way of, you know, his sex performance, let's say that way. Because, he's so unsexy. I mean, if you're writing a male character, you don't want, like, boom, boom, boom. Like, come on, where's the conversation? Like,
There's no intimacy. Yeah.
No intimacy. You can
I think it's not only conversation. It's like the character. If you are casting two people that they're going to be having sex, come on.
Well, I found them, the Duke.
Yeah, find it.
I found them okay.
He's very pretty, but do you have hair chemistry with this?
No.
With this actress,
right? And then can you match her? You know what I mean? That's something you cannot just fabricate. You have to find. You have to do. So it may be a casting problem. I mean, maybe that this actor is wonderful in other stuff. So because I haven't seen him in anything, so I don't know. So it may be a writing problem. It may be a casting problem. But something quite didn't work there. And then we can talk about costumes. I do want to talk about the costumes.
Yes.
And then as soon as you, Nene, your wonderful moderator, move us to that topic, but we can keep talking about the sex because it's, we can keep talking about it.
No, okay. We've been through the major topics around the series so far, so I think we can touch the costumes when we talk about what we like the most and what we like the less of the entire series. I would call it the tops and flops category of the conversation. So Adriana, let's start with you. Name three things that you liked a lot, that you found very good, and three things that you found very bad in the entire series.
In the entire series? About everything? About anything?
About everything. Three things that you found very good and three things that you found very bad.
I have to say the whole, all the costumes and all the sets, I thought they were fantastic. I love the sets. Everything was so colorful. All the costumes were wonderful. That was very eye-catching. So I really enjoyed that. It was different. It was not historically accurate. I didn't care. It was pretty, and I loved it. I also loved how they used modern music as background. Like they would play, you know, Billie Eilish song, Bad Guy, but as instrumental in the dance scene. I thought that was fantastic. I loved that. I love that. That was a win. So if they're doing a show and they're doing it, you know, this anachronistical type of show where it's a period film, but there's modern stuff to it, this is the way to do it. Bring in the interesting costume, bring in like the wonderful modern music, but, you know, modified as you know, like as music of that time. And that was a total win for me. So I really enjoyed that. And then I enjoyed some of the characters. I enjoyed them a lot. I enjoyed the Marina character. To me, was surprising. It was very complex, and I couldn't tell what she was going to do next. Mm-hmm. And then
unpredictable, yeah.
It was unpredictable. And then and I could relate to her and her struggle. And then she had like a real problem, not like the Duke of Hastings. Like the Duke of Hastings was a fake problem that he created for himself. And it was so dumb. Like I could not relate. Dude, just do your thing. You say it. You know, I don't want to have kids. I don't want to get married. You know, fuck you. You can edit this out. And so, you know, real conflict instead of fake conflict. So that was the thing. And then I enjoyed the queen a lot, the queen character. I thought she was fantastic. And Lady Dunbury too, I thought.
Yes.
And then the Featherington family. I thought some characters were interesting too. The bad things were, you know, the whole Daphne, the Hastings. That fed flat for me, even though, you know, their relationship was interesting at the beginning, and then this fake issue took over and I lost interest in them. And then all the Bridgerton brothers issues, problems, they were completely bland characters. I could not tell the actors apart. I could not. I did not learn their names. I did not care for them. Every time they show up, I was like, who is this person? Why am I wasting my time watching this person here? Because I don't care for them. I don't know who they are. So what are you doing? Like, are you even in this show? Were you there before? Like, I couldn't tell them apart. I'm sorry. Pick a better character. I don't know if it was the actors or if it was. So this is where you say you have a diverse show, but you have a whole set of characters that look all the same and have no diversity to them, and there is like no difference. So this is the contradiction about this show. You have a show that is diverse, you know, in paper, but then when you actually watching the show, you have a bunch of characters that you cannot even tell apart. So that was
very good.
Those are my main issues.
Tops and flaws. So how about you? How about you, Nene? Three things you found very good. Three things you found very bad.
Okay, I'm gonna start with the flops, because honestly, it's hard for me to think of the tops. and I love everything Adriana had to say, but we run over our time here. So flops. The idea of bringing in the issue of race and not taking it all the way, not investigating
the implications of this. This would have been very interesting. Of course, not every show has to be serious and so on. But, you know, I think the writing, and I think they still have a chance to do that in subsequent seasons. So that was, for me, a little bit of a letdown. It would have been interesting. But I think this is a reflection of the overall kind of laziness of the writing. I don't know how to put it. The overall kind of lacking of the writing. So that's my first flop. My second flop will be Eloise. Oh, God. I know she's... Now that Adriana explained it, now I understand she's supposed to stand in for the Shonda Rhimes, a typical female character. She did not work for me. She was the most anachronistic of all things, and it just didn't work. The actress was wonderful. And I'm going to say something here that might be a little bit like... you know, people who love this actress will be like outraged. She reminded me of the great, amazing Judy Davis. She's an English actress, and she played George Sand in Impromptu and many other movies. And she has this kind of way of acting a little bit. So I recommend that you look at it and you will see the similarities. However, it did not work for me. And let's see how she develops throughout. It's very good. Her point of view has to be presented in the story because, yes, the women are extremely constrained in this period, but I found the character just jarring. The third flop would be the queen. I mean, the queen could have been such a fantastic character, but she was just there. Why would Queen care about Daphne? I'm sorry. No.
Her queendom was so small. Her queendom was just too family.
She only cares about
nothing else for her to
what? Queen. Yeah. Over. So no. So that's the third flop among many others.
That's a world building problem.
There you go. Adriana has the right terminology. Okay. Now the tops. I thought the actress that played Daphne is quite interesting, intelligent. She was able to show that inner life. I mean, as much as she could, a little bit of more inner life, a little bit more of the complexity of the situation. She needs to marry. You know, she has to deal. I mean, and you have the two opposite. It's like a little bit like Adriana and I. You have a realistic person and a romantic person. A realistic person deals with what she has at hand. She needs to marry. She needs to do this. No matter what, you know, how hard that is. And Eloise is like, I refuse to accept this reality, essentially. So I think Daphne and the actress did a good job in, you know, giving a little bit of the conflict here. Another top will be, I did love how the show looked. Lots of flowers, lots of wallpaper, beautiful setting. Really, really gorgeous. The costumes here and there. I thought the Featherington, I think the mother Featherington, because she was dressed as a 1950s person, like 20th century person. I every time she would come in, I was like, where am I? What century am I? And this is my problem. This is not a problem. You know, producers have all the freedom to do what they want, but it did take me out of the story. But overall, the setting is beautiful. And I guess the third top will be, it's a period thing. It's a period series. And I love period films and period series. So just essentially, I'm going to watch something that is set in a different time and that shows the life of women. For me, that's important.
Very good, Nene.
What about
you? I'm going to go last. And I hope to make it as short as possible. I want to start with the tops because when I started watching the series, I was very into it right away. And maybe because of that, because I love everything in period style. So it was in England, a country that I'm very interested in and I love. It was with a lot of costumes and it took me right away because, yeah, as you said, I am attracted to such things and I liked it. So the entire production, I felt very good. Yeah, I found very well. They obviously took a lot of detail. They paid attention to many details for the looks. Yeah, all these the ballrooms, the costumes, and all the flowers, what you mentioned, all the flowers, they made it look really, really nice. And there were some scenes where the dancing of the couples in the balls, it was choreographed, and I found that very refreshing. And this is maybe one of the, this is my second top. I loved that modern touch to the show. It reminded me of Romeo and Juliet, the version of Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes, because I loved that back then, that they took an old story and they put it modern. And in Bridgerton, they did something similar, to throw this modern touch into it, that they would dance choreographed to Billie Eilish playing by a string quartet. I loved that touch. And that the Featheringtons looked so differently. Of course it is. Of course you know, okay, this is not accurate to the time. But I found it kind of like part of this fantasy world that they were creating. So, as to say, what if the fabrics they use for
the Featheringtons, they were like new rich, so that's what they were dressed like that. While the Bridgertons, they were old rich, so they were dressed.
They were
like
very classic.
Yeah, which was I thought it was a very interesting way to show it.
Yeah, but many of the fabrics and stuff that they use, and many of the patterns they used, I'm pretty sure they was pretty modern. So I like this touch, this modern touch into the entire show. And that would be pretty much it of what I liked of the entire thing. Yeah. And of course my third top, to see this, we don't see it that often. And this is why we chose to talk about Bridgerton. This element of the pseudo diverse cast, to see a black duke and to see a black queen, was for me refreshing as a viewer, because I don't see that very often on television or on films. And for me, it was like throwing a very interesting question in my head to say, what if this would be the new, this would be the normal thing, you know? This was for me like kind of like, this is a good question. I like to think about it. What I found floppy, my flops, how superficial the entire relationship between the Duke and Daphne was. It was, like a turn off. It was very superficial. Also some of the elements that drive the story, like the motivation of the Duke not wanting to marry, this was really just silly, plain silly. And it takes the story so much of what makes it interesting. So the story was, at the end, if you take it really by the core, it's very weak. It's very weak. So you just keep on watching because you say, okay, I want to watch it till the end to see how does he get out of it, yeah? So I found, the relationship too superficial, the story a little bit also too vain. And some of the characters, I agree with both of you, some of the characters were just annoying and just, kind of not necessary to the entire story. That would be my wrap up.
Well, we have spoken for an hour about Bridgerton. Does it really deserve? I don't know. I think it does. It's an interesting concept, and I think it is important to, you know, especially for the period film and period series, the monopoly on this is by the BBC Masterpiece Theatre. So to have Netflix investing in a period piece, I think is very interesting for the genre, and for created very much for an American audience. That's interesting. That's quite interesting. And I will watch the subsequent seasons to see what happens. So just to wrap it up, to finish, we're going to do our ratings. So Adriana, our ratings are from 1 to 10, wicks and candles. So how many wicks and candles do you give Bridgerton?
So it's this rating of the quality of the show, of the funness of the show.
Your personal rating.
It's just my rating. If you summarize, doesn't matter everything. What I'm rating. Just in general. Okay. I think I will give it, I think I'm going to give it 6 out of 10. And the reason why is I would have given this show before watching like 2 out of 10. But this show kind of surprised me with some characters. You know, there were some things that were surprising. They show, and you know, I could finish it. I was able to finish. That would keep me interested until the end, even though I was laughing at this, the Duke of Hastings issues and things like that. You know, I wanted to find out what will happen with Lady Whistledom. Like, and we didn't even talk about that, but that was also a kind of head scratcher. So I will say 6 out of 10. That will be my final score.
That's great. Thank you very much, Adri. Yeah, we didn't talk about Lady Whistledom. Maybe we need to do another episode anyway. So, Gabby, what is your rating? How many wicks and candles do you give Bridgerton?
I'm going to go also for 6, surprisingly, because I watched it with a lot of interest, and I think we watched it around Christmas, so we watched it all pretty much in one day because we had nothing else to do. So it kept us hooked until the end. So, and because the main things that make a show great are the story and the characters, and that's their biggest failure. So everything that looks is beautiful and I love it. And as I mentioned, this modern touches, I loved it, but the story let me down.
Thank you, Gabby. Thank you for that.
How about you, Nene?
For me, I've been thinking about this a lot. I was going to go with 5 wicks and candles. However, I'm going to give an entire wick and candle to Lady Danbury, to the actress Ajoa Ando, because she was the only brilliant thing of this entire series. I mean, she was beautiful. She was fierce. She was amazing. Her accent, the way she saved the Duke. So she takes an entire wick and candle and takes the rating to 6.
To 6.
Oh, wow.
And by the way, we had a lot of wicks in this show in spite of the beans and water, because the wicks of the queen,
yes,
they were a piece of art. They were so sassy and
beautiful
and refreshing and beautiful because they were really creatively made. So there were some wicks.
There were some wicks.
There definitely were wicks here.
There were wicks, even though at this time, you know, the wearing of wicks was kind of fading, but so anyway, 5, but it goes up to 6 because of Lady Danbury. And essentially what I ask of period films is to teach me something of the period, and I learned nothing about the period watching Bridgerton. but to be fair, this is not Bridgerton's job. It is just my fault. I expected something that the show could not give me. It was fun. It was fun. And I hope to see the actors in other things.
And I think this is maybe what we have to keep in mind, that the show had another goal. And we were maybe expecting too much. It was, let's attract a young audience and throw this question at them about diversity.
I think we were maybe expecting
something else.
Maybe the show wasn't there to teach you anything, and most shows are not there to teach you anything, just to entertain you. And I think that's the main goal of any show, to entertain you. And this show did entertain me, but it was very superficial entertainment.
Yeah.
It didn't give me anything to think about. Like, it didn't give me that, you know, feeling that I'm like, God, you know, like I'm thinking about this and all the implication and all the characters. It's wonderful. It's just like you just watch it, you finish, you laugh at the sex scenes, you're done. So,
unintentionally
funny sex scenes.
I mean, I know we moved on from this topic, but that ceiling point of view scene with the Duke, no. Just
Which one?
From the top, and we see the Duke from behind, the pushing. No, thanks.
Okay, I can remember that one.
I'm sorry, I brought it.
I think I erased those scene from my memory already. And I was like, no.
Okay. Okay. Well, we have given the series 18 wicks and candles. Ooh. out of 30. Wow. You know, we could talk so much more, obviously. You know, we could rate this series out of entertainment, beauty, all of those things. This is overall ratings. I still recommend everybody watch if you haven't. I mean, there were a million spoilers in this show, but probably you already watched it. Anyway, I want to say thank you to Gabby and thank you to Adriana, especially, who's so busy. And today she's quite sick as well. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk about Bridgerton with us.
Oh, that was wonderful. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you, Adri. And I think you brought so much insight to the show in exactly what we wanted to have from you. And you have fulfilled that.
Oh,
to the point.
So glad.
Yes.
Yeah, and thank you.
So glad to hear that.
And I'm going to put you in a tricky situation. I hope you do come back in the future. Thank you so much.
I would love to. I can talk forever about TV. So
There you go. Perfect. Yeah. Well, thank you everybody for listening. That's our episode. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Stay tuned.
Bye-bye.
Wicks and Candles is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
So go ahead and subscribe and follow us on Instagram at Wicks and Candles. Thanks for listening and see you next time.
Wicks and Candles is written, hosted, and produced by Andreina Romero and Gabriela Morgan Romero. The image design is by Pamela Rollin. The podcast theme music is the Concerto for Two Violins in D minor by Johann Sebastian Bach.